This is a Climate Challenge, a podcast by the International PhD College of the University of Bologna on the social environmental crisis. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our new podcast episode, How to Promote Pro-Environmental Behaviors. I'm Rou Jingwu, a PhD student in the International PhD College of Collegio Superiore, and I'm also a PhD in economics at the University of Bologna. I am your host in this episode. In previous episodes, we already discussed a lot of consequences caused by the climate change. Therefore, in this episode, we are exploring how behavior change, both individually and societally, are crucial alongside technological and economic solutions to meet the challenge of ecological transition. We are very excited to have with us two experts in the field of environmental conservation, who will share their insights, experiences, and inspirations. Before today's episode, we will do two small tests. Now, please close your eyes. Imagine what a world altered by climate change looks like in the future. It's tough, right? The lack of a vivid image can really soften the urgency of our environmental issues. Then the second test is that, do you know how much water and energy you use for each showering? How much carbon footprint you produce for each showering? Just like our struggle to visualize a climate change future, many of us might not have a clear idea of the impact our daily routines have on the planet. This gap in understanding can often lead to less urgency in addressing what we can do right now to make a difference. To help us bridge these gaps and explore ways to foster more sustainable behaviors, we are joined by an expert in the field. Our guest today is Dr. Simon Fang, postdoctoral research fellow at the SET Business School at the University of Oxford. He is also a senior research fellow in the Institute for New Economic Thinking at Oxford Martin School of the University of Oxford. Dr. Fang holds a PhD in economics from the University of Bonn and specializes in behavioral economics, environmental economics, and applied microeconomics. He has published in the Journal of Public Economics and is currently working on a project that assesses the potential of entertainment and virtual reality to encourage pro-environmental behavior. Dr. Fang, it's great to have you with us. Before we dive into the specifics of your research, could you share a bit about your journey in the field of environmental economics and behavioral economics? What initially drew you to this area of research?
Sure. Yes, I was always interested in behavioral economics and environmental economics and climate change as a student. But what really put me on this path is, well, it happened that when I was doing my master's studies, I was looking for a supervisor for my master's thesis. And I did something very scary back then. I wrote a cold email to a professor I'd never spoken to before and I never met before, who was very new at the department at that time. And that was Lawrence Götte, who later turned out to be my PhD supervisor. I wrote a very long and detailed email about what my interests are and why I want to write my master's thesis with him. I sent him a CV, I sent him my grades. He replied within 1 minute, certainly not reading all of the things I had sent him, saying, oh yeah, sounds good, let's have a meeting. And it so happened that he was looking for someone who could help him with a field experiment they were running in Singapore, which was on a behavioral economics experiment to promote water conservation in Singapore. So that's what started my career. It happened to be at the same time that I wanted to write my thesis. He sent me to Singapore to help with a field experiment, and that really put me on the path of research in the area of behavioral economics and environmental economics. That just really goes to show you how much just small random things influence your life path and how far a little bit of proactivity and serendipity can go.
I also want to say it's a super randomized starter, but I mean, this way is quite good to start and good to know that you started in this way and you're really enjoying this. Now, I'm also very curious about your research projects. So moving forward, one of the challenges in addressing climate change is the difficulty that many of us face in visualizing potential future scenarios about climate change. It seems like a significant barrier to fostering a deeper understanding and emotional connection with the impacts of our environmental choices. So, Dr. Fang, in your research, how do you help people overcome this challenge and enhance their ability to image these future situations?
Thank you. Yes, I mean, climate change is really a wicked problem, isn't it? Rich, developed countries, we have the privilege that we have experienced so far very few of the consequences of climate change that we will all be facing in the future. Sure, there have been increases in heat waves and floods and droughts, wildfires, also in developed countries recently. But by and large, climate change for many of us in the rich world is still more of a, you know, abstract or statistical threat that happens to other people in other countries in the future. And that is compounded by this sort of shifting baseline effect that as the climate changes, we get used to it and we don't remember how things were 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So it's really, psychologically, it's a very difficult issue to process for us humans. We've not evolved to process these sorts of existential large-scale risks like climate change. So how we try to approach this is through, okay, when we don't have personal experiences of these potential threats of climate change, can we use media experiences or fictional narratives or stories instead to help people imagine what a world in the future might look like, both in a, you know, bad scenario when we've failed to address climate change and on the livelihoods of many people will be impacted by the consequences of that, but also the positive scenarios where we've managed to collectively work together and address the issue of climate change and succeed in limiting global temperatures to 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees Celsius. So what we've done here is we've looked at this using a virtual reality tool that was helped develop by Sony Interactive Entertainment. And we've run studies with this at the United Nations Environmental Assembly earlier this year in February and March 2024. What we tried to test there is to see, first of all, what if we approach these very knowledgeable delegates on environmental issues and ask them about how they mentally imagine the future of climate change, we often find that people don't have a very, you know, very vivid imagery about potential climate scenarios, even though they talk about these things all day long. So we try to look at how a virtual reality experience, that means an audiovisual experience that really helps visualize planet Earth and the climate systems on planet Earth and how temperatures and our climate system have evolved in the past and will potentially evolve in the future, how these sorts of immersive experiences can help people understand or process more vividly what it means when we talk about climate change. And what we find there is that having these sorts of virtual reality experiences really helps people in imagining what climate change means. And this is in line with other research that shows that media experiences, mass media experiences, can influence our values or aspirations and norms and how we think about our futures.
Yeah, I think it's quite cool that you use the virtual reality and do such intervention for the United Nations Climate Change such a conference. I think also only the people who get such experience can have the perfect 53 image on the future. So if we don't have the opportunity to, I mean, get such experience, maybe VR would be super strong to help people have such an image. It's a really fascinating project. Also, it's very clear that visualizing the future can significantly shape our response to climate change. Not only conception gap, but also there are some daily life behavior will result in big difference in climate change. Also, I found that you've been working on some practical interventions to help reduce the environmental impacts of daily activities. For example, the showering, which will use a considerable amount of water and energy in households. And also, I know that you've collaborated with a technical company on interventions to reduce water usage during showers in both Germany and Singapore. As you mentioned, how do you start to do climate change, right? Your supervisor asked you to go to Singapore to conduct such a field experiment. So I'm very curious about these initiatives and the role of behavioral economics in promoting such pro-environmental behaviors.
Indeed, great question. One of the developments in the recent decades is that more and more people are becoming aware of this issue of climate change and they're willing to do something against it. But we often find that people have intentions, good intentions, to reduce their carbon footprint, to behave more sustainably. But when we look at their actual behavior, their actions, that often is not necessarily consistent with the good intentions. And one reason that might be the case is that often in our everyday life, we don't really understand that well how much, what impacts our behavior has on the environment, for example. We've had this difficult task in the beginning of estimating the greenhouse gas emissions caused by showering. Showering is an interesting behavior because when we talk of showering, all of your listeners know how showering works, I imagine. So I don't have to explain anything about that. But showering obviously is something that requires water, but most of us also don't just take cold showers, we take warm showers. And taking warm showers means that we need energy to heat up this water in very fast. So what many people don't realize is that heating up water is the second largest driver of household energy consumption after room heating and room cooling. So in this project, in one of the projects in which we conducted in student dorms in Germany, what we were really interested in was how does people's showering behavior change or not change when we inform them about how much energy and how much greenhouse gas emissions through water heating is caused by showering. And I should mention that in Germany, water heating is still often done using fossil fuels, so oil or gas. So obviously very emissions heavy, emission intensive. So what we did was test an intervention where we wrote an email, which basically explained to people on average, when you shower, you use so and so many liters of water, say 40 liters of water. That corresponds due to water heating to so and so many kilowatt hours of energy. And that then leads to greenhouse gas emissions of so and so much kilograms, which corresponds to what, say, 20 trees can absorb within 1 year, assuming that you take one shower every day. And what we find is that giving people this information has no effect whatsoever on their energy conservation behavior in the shower. But we also did a second thing in the study, which is we didn't just give them information through these emails. We also installed smart shower meters in the showers, in the bathrooms. Yeah, you mentioned this cooperation with tech companies. We cooperated with a company called Amphero, which developed and produces these smart meters, which are basically installed in the shower and they have a display. And on the display, it can show you in real time how much water you're currently using. And what we found in this study is when we show people how much water they are using in real time while they're in the shower and constantly facing this display, people actually do reduce the time they spend in the shower. And that means also the hot water, the amount of hot water they use in the shower. Interestingly, we also find that information about greenhouse gas emissions, although it doesn't have an effect if we send it to people in isolation, has a strong effect when people already have a smart meter installed in their showers that shows how much water they are consuming in real time. And the reason for this is we believe that, well, knowledge alone is not enough. And that is one of the key lessons from behavioral economics. We're not, you know, rational agents with unlimited cognitive capacity who use and process all the information that is available to us and make, you know, a calculated choice of what to do. But we're often driven by things like biases, like limited attention or self-control problems. And that could apply very well in the shower. In the shower, under the hot water, and you just forget about time, you don't pay attention to things like climate change or water or energy consumption. And what the real-time feedback through the smart meter really does is draws attention. It tells you, oh, look, pay attention. What you're doing actually has an effect on other things. We find that through these sorts of interventions, in our case, we reduced water and energy consumption in our sample by about 20%.
Wow, that sounds really incredible, impactful. So as I understand, you have such technologies, it's shower meters, right? And using these, giving them the real-time feedback and learn there is a super strong effect on students' showering behavior, right? It's remarkable how small such an intervention can facilitate such a significant change in our habits like showering and environmental too. And in light of these successes, what are some challenges you've faced in implementing these interventions, and how have you addressed them, and what should we pay attention to if we want to do such intervention in a larger population group, like a scale-up such intervention?
Fantastic question. So I've talked about one study that we conducted. There are many more studies on these sorts of behavioral interventions, also using, you know, smart meters or technological tools to help people conserve energy or water in the household. And we have plenty of evidence by now about how real-time feedback and goal setting can encourage household energy and water conservation and other sorts of pro-environmental behavior. One of the challenges that we frequently encounter is that despite knowing how effective these tools can be, or maybe even because we know how effective these tools can be, it's sometimes very difficult to convince people to actually adopt and take up these tools and convince local governments or, you know, public bodies to promote the use of these, in our case, these shower meters. And that is unfortunately a huge challenge, because there's no use if we know that something works, but no one wants it, right? There's another study where I'm not involved with, but which also uses these sorts of shower meters, which show that when people actually participate in an experiment and they get to try these shower meters, and then they're asked how much are they willing to pay for these shower meters, they're often willing to pay more than the monetary value of saving water and energy would be. It seems to be the case that in principle, there is demand for these devices, but it's incredibly difficult to convince people to take up these devices when they haven't tried or even have heard of them yet. And of course, these smart shower meters, you know, I've talked about now, are just one example. Technology adoption for these metering tools or other tools that, or other technologies that can help us reduce our energy consumption in the household, is really one of the key issues that we're facing, and one of the areas where behavioral economics also can provide a lot of insight. So think, for example, about rooftop solar, so rooftop photovoltaic, rooftop PV, and the adoption of that, or heat pumps, a much cleaner way and more effective, efficient way also to generate room heating than old fossil fuel-based heating systems. Recently in Germany, for example, there was a heating law which tried to subsidize and promote the source of heat pumps, but it faced huge, huge backlash and resistance from parts of the population. I think one of the fundamental challenges that behavioral economics also teaches us about is that people face a lot of, like, people are, I don't want to say lazy, but people are, and that applies to me as well, I should say. We don't really like changing our established ways of life, do we? We're set in our habits, and it's a nice and comfortable life. And as long as there's no huge threat, that huge immediate threat that throws us out of these habits, we just keep sticking with them. So there's often this sort of status quo bias or skepticism with regard to adopting new things, new technologies, new lifestyles, accepting new policies. And that is a huge challenge that we need to address.
Thank you for sharing such cases and examples. And at least let me have a clear idea on some difficulties or challenges to make such interventions get up. Also, thank you for sharing those practical steps our listeners can take to reduce the environmental impacts through everyday actions like sharing. But as you say, maybe we are very lazy and stick to the lifestyle we already used to.
But maybe I can say that we can also use these kind of stickiness of our behavior to our advantage. If we manage to establish new habits, then these often stick. This generates really a potential also for behavioral change if we manage to nudge people into another lifestyle. And once they get used to it, they might just continue, they might just decide to stick with it and continue with it. So it's also, you know, these sorts of sticky habits are also are not just a challenge, but also an opportunity for future research.
I totally agree. Like, the coin has two sides. We always can make such challenge or difficulty to be maybe the new opportunities. I'm also curious about a broader topic that directly impacts the success of these environmental efforts on a larger scale. Like, ambitious policies like carbon taxations are essential for the green transition, yet they often face significant hurdles due to lack of public support. Like you also say that people are not willing to adopt a new technology or something. This can slow down the pace of the green transition and presents a major obstacle. So could you share some opinion why these ambitious policies often lack public support and how your research addresses this issue? And additionally, how can we have more public support for such policies?
Yes, very important. Thank you. So on public support for environmental policies, climate policies, we do indeed often encounter, you know, backlash and opposition from parts of the population against implementing these sorts of policies that we know will be essential for the sustainable transition. Now, I don't want to condemn these people because often their concerns are very legitimate, but let's unpack this a bit. So one of the aspects, elements we know from a lot of previous research is that how you design these policies really do matters. So if people perceive a policy as a burden, as, you know, a personal cost to them, then indeed, we know that that can reduce public acceptance for these policies. In addition, people often have kind of distributional concerns about the equality of certain policies. We have seen that in France, for example, with the Gilets Jaunes movement, which was spurred by Emmanuel Macron's gasoline tax proposal, which was really perceived as unfair burden on people who are poor and struggling already anyway. So it's, first of all, it's the perceived cost that that these climate policies put on yourself, but also the distributional concerns, the fairness concerns about which are the people, are these, is it the rich people or the poor people in society who bear these costs? So fairness concerns. And another concern is also another kind of policy specific concern is people often don't understand or don't perceive in the same way as economists or experts do, how effective different policies are. So many people, for example, when we talk about climate policy, economists or many experts would say that carbon pricing through either carbon tax or carbon trade markets are the most important and the most effective policy to enable the sustainable transition. But the general public usually doesn't have such a good working understanding of economics and equilibrium behavior, and often prefers more direct approaches, like, you know, bans, command and control approaches, and subsidies. This is something that has to be taken into account, first of all, already in the designing of green policies to make sure that they don't put an unfair burden, if you want, on poor people, on people with low incomes who are struggling anyway, and that they're perceived by people as legitimate and effective policy tools. That is the design of these policies. Another dimension is that, well, many people aren't actually so involved with politics and all these news and the policy discussions in much detail, actually. What matters for many people is less what actually is written down in law about each specific policy proposals, but more what they kind of what they feel about it, what they hear about it in the media from friends and colleagues and their social networks, what the general vibe is around this policy or different proposals, if you want. And there really we need to take into account the sort of social media environment that we live in nowadays, but especially with social media and the logic of the attention economy, where things often go viral, which are very negative. So, you know, there's research showing that people tend to exhibit a negativity bias. We're more likely to read or watch something when it includes negative messages, outrage, and these sorts of things, rather than, you know, positive and constructive messages. Especially in kind of this era of growing polarization, it's a pretty tough challenge, which implies that often what we want to do is also start with the framing of the messages or framing of different policy proposals before it gets, you know, get into this machinery of polarization and outrage. And that kind of implies that, well, we often think of policies as, well, if the majority of people support it, then we should pass it. But we should also maybe think about frame messages or policies in a way that prevents outrage, so that makes sure that it doesn't give too much food to firebrands who want to exploit something to generate more clicks or views or to gain political capital from just pure fundamental resistance against something. So two things here. One, it is important to kind of control the narrative early on. And second is design policies in a way and frame them in a way that minimize this sort of potential for outrage.
You really mentioned many very crucial points. Also, I think through these points, I understand that maybe that also under let public people understanding policy is super important. Also, understanding public concerns also seems there is the key to addressing them. Oh, maybe could you briefly tell us more about a specific strategy your research has identified to help change public opinion on carbon taxation in the United States, and which way is the most efficient way? Could you briefly tell us?
Sure. So we've run a study, we meaning Stefania Innocenti from the Smith School of Environment in Oxford and me, and what we looked at is we recruited, it was an online experiment and a representative sample in the United States, adults. And what we were interested in is how can we promote support for carbon pricing policies. So as I mentioned before, one of the policies that economists would consider the most efficient and effective policies to address climate change. Now, in the US currently, there is no nationwide carbon price. And there have been attempts in the past, but have all unfortunately failed by Barack Obama, for example, or who tried to establish a cap and trade market. Also by bipartisan groups in recent years who have tried to push forward proposals. And this seems to be very, very difficult politically to, you know, to implement. So what we tried to understand is there a way that might help people accept these sorts of carbon pricing policies or carbon taxation policies. What we looked at is, well, two different aspects. The first aspect is we tried to explain to people how carbon pricing works, you know, in simple layman terms, but including all the economic intuitions of if we put a tax on carbon emissions, that means prices for high emitting products will be higher, and that will lead in equilibrium to a reduction in demand for in consumption and production of emitting product high emissions products, and an increase in the production and demand for low emitting technologies and products, and also create incentives for technological progress in green technologies. All these sorts of things we try to explain to people in an information video. That is one thing that we did, and we do find that explaining to people how these policies work and also alleviating some concerns about, what does it mean for households? Does it put a how much additional cost would it mean for households? Or is there a way to alleviate these concerns through revenue recycling schemes, like redistributing the revenues generated from carbon pricing? This sort of kind of knowledge, pure knowledge-based intervention does, we do indeed see that in the short term, we can increase support for these policies by about 5 percentage points. Now, interestingly, there's another dimension that we also looked at, and that is a social dimension. I mentioned before, like what we think of something also depends on what we hear from other people and what we think other people will think. Social scientists call this social norms, right? So what we think other people do and what we think other people think we should think, which is quite a mouthful. But let me just tell you maybe more concretely what we did. So what might be surprising to many people who follow politics in the Western world, but specifically in the US, is that actually there is a large social consensus that we need to address climate change, and that the US should take steps to become carbon neutral. So what we took as a starting point was a large-scale survey conducted by the Pew Research Center, which finds that in a representative sample of 10,000 Americans, 69% actually support the carbon neutrality goals of the US, reach net zero by 2050. 69% of people in the US support this. I mean, really taking this number. That means it's not just, as we might imagine, Democrats versus Republicans. There's actually, surprisingly, maybe to many, to some people, two-thirds of young Americans, that is, Americans under the age of 30 or 40, are very worried about climate change and are very engaged in these topics and support climate action. So what we did is we tried to make use of this kind of false social reality that many people perceive, that climate action does not have a majority support in population, by simply telling people, look, actually, by the way, 69% of Americans, including Democrats, Republicans, and independents, are in support of the US carbon neutrality goals. And what we find is that simple information, has the same effect as explaining in detail how the policy works. That suggests also kind of really what we need to maybe wrench back is the narrative that we may get from, watching TV or reading the news or following social media, that there's a huge polarization about climate change. Well, there's some truth to it, there is some polarization about it, but also the large majority of people support it. Climate action is hugely popular. And with this narrative, we find that we can achieve the same effect on carbon policy support, carbon pricing support, as a detailed explanation of how the policy works. Now, another interesting thing that comes out of this story is that the perceived social reality, if you want, doesn't just have an effect in itself, but it also has an additional kind of interaction effect on how you perceive neutral information about, the carbon pricing policy and climate change in general. What we find is that when we've previously told people about the 69% number, the social consensus, if you want, on climate action, then people are also more open to, hearing about the topic of climate change and potential approaches to address this, like carbon pricing. They're more open to these sorts of information. So what we find is that when we ask people how politically biased they perceived our information that we give them on climate change and carbon pricing, people who've learned about the 69% number are less inclined to say that it was very politically biased. which is, I believe, an important lesson, especially in our polarized era, that what matters is was first of all our kind of cognitive understanding, but also the social norms that we perceive. So the direction we think society is going towards. And if we can establish, kind of start establishing a narrative that we are able to address climate change and we want to address climate change, and most people want to address climate change, I think that could also give us a kind of push into the right direction.
Wow, I'm also quite surprised with the research results you shared. Also, I think most impressive point for me is actually the social norms. Also, this point remind me of the memory doing also the podcast with the Professor Tafoni, and he is doing the green thinking. He would also discuss with you about the climate change and the behavioral economics. It's also kind of related to social norms, and he is super curious about your opinion about how far will behavior change get us on the path decarbonization via maybe the supply side policy and also about the demand side point. And do you think how many percentage of the population, if they hold such opinion, will achieve such a green tipping point?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I have a very good answer to this, but I do have some opinions, at least. I hope they're informative in some way. So I think, so how far can behavioral change get us? Now, I think that behavioral change alone certainly is not going to get us to 1.5 degrees Celsius or towards the sustainable transition. But I also think that without behavioral change, we're definitely not getting there. So the way I see it, there's really three areas where behavior or kind of understanding, kind of the psychology, or the behavioral economics, insights of how people perceive and react to climate change are key. So the first is that reducing, trying to behave more sustainably, reducing your carbon footprint by, for example, mitigation behavior, by reducing consumption in the domain of household energy use, for example, or transport. So aviation is a huge driver. Another area that is maybe most impactful with regard to behavioral change is dietary choice. In essence, less meat, more plants are better for the environment. And these sorts of consumption-reducing, sustainable lifestyle changes are important in areas, especially when we are facing hard-to-abate behaviors or hard-to-abate areas. So hard to abate, meaning that areas where it's difficult really to find and scale up new technologies that are net zero or low carbon. One of these areas, as I mentioned, is aviation, so flying. It's incredibly difficult to find technological solutions that really emit zero carbon greenhouse gas emissions. Food consumption is another area. Which is hard to debate because we all need to eat. There's just no way around it. But kind of changing what we eat, so reducing, especially red meat consumption, beef is well, one thing that probably has the largest impact. Reducing beef consumption, reducing red meat consumption in general would probably be, I'm talking about, sorry, I'm talking about developed countries here, not developing countries. In the developed world, certainly kind of reducing beef consumption would be better for the environment and for our health. Now, that's hard to debate areas. Another area is another reason is technological lock-in. So there's some areas where we know we have low carbon technologies, but it just takes time to switch from the old fossil fuel-based dirty technologies to these new technologies. For example, in heating, room heating, many of the houses, buildings in Western countries are still heated through fossil fuels, and there is a shift away towards more sustainable heating, but it's going to take time. There's certainly still going to be oil heating systems and gas-based heating systems around in 5 years and 10 years. There's also an area where when we're still locked into these old technologies, One thing we can do to reduce emissions is by changing our behavior and reducing demand. We've seen this recently in the recent years also when the Ukraine war started, when Russia invaded Ukraine and the gas prices and energy prices increased a lot. I mean, in many countries in Europe, we've faced this gas price crisis, and many governments started to put an emphasis on really reducing demand. And we've seen that, households do respond to these appeals. We've seen, for example, in Germany, I think 5 percentage point reduction in energy demand in response to this crisis. And these things do have an effect, even if it's small. Another example is internal combustion engine cars and the switch to electric vehicles. It's going to take time. In 10 years, there's still going to be, ICE cars around. So there's still lots of areas where change in behavior can have an impact, even if in the long run we need technological solutions. Now, speaking of technology, I've mentioned this before, but technology adoption is probably a more even more important area where behavioral change matters. So I think I've talked about rooftop PV before, rooftop solar. There's, speaking of social norms and social tipping, there's evidence that the more neighbors, causal evidence, that the more neighbors have installed visible solar panels on their roofs, the more likely you are also to adopt solar technology. And these sort of increases in demand, demand-side adoption of green technologies like solar or electric vehicles, if you want, heat pumps, these can lead to a complementary effect on production and supply side changes towards the green transition. So especially with solar, I mean, we've seen in the recent 10 years a huge, huge drop in the price of solar energy by a factor of more than 5, I think even 10. And that is, that can only happen by the interplay of demand side, so behavioral change patterns, and supply side. So an increase in demand means that suppliers, can scale up their production, which leads to, learning by doing, which, can help reduce the cost of technologies. It draws in new competitors and, incentives to, generate new innovations and R&D that can further reduce the costs of solar. So these are kind of sort of virtuous spirals that can be triggered, among others, by behavioral changes towards adopting more low carbon technologies. And these feedback effects, societal feedback effects, are really one area where the whole society, consumers, firms, and policymakers make a difference and need to work together. And maybe finally, I've mentioned policymakers now, and we've talked about the policymaker study. Another area, of course, where we maybe need to understand behavioral insights and psychological insights better is in acceptance of ambitious climate policies. Because also for firms and innovators, having kind of a commitment to a policy path towards net zero is, and don't not having the uncertainty that future governments might backtrack on the net zero pledges and green policies. This sort of acceptance towards a com like towards a commitment towards a policy goal of reaching net zero, that will also be key.
Thank you very much for sharing such very fantastic points. Also, in my view, it's like once you break through such points and supply and the demand, these two sides is more likely to reinforce the cycle and they actually promote each other. Thank you again, Dr. Wang, and thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today. To all our listeners, we hope this discussion invites you to think more critically about your role in combating climate change and encourages you to take both small and large steps towards a more sustainable future. Remember, every action counts in our collective effort to protect our planet. Continue to stay engaged, spread the word, and help us move towards a sustainable future. Join us next time. Goodbye.
You have been listening to Climate Challenge, a podcast by the International PhD College of the University of Bologna. You can find all episodes all the references and additional information on the college in the show description.